this episode of The Commercial Break.
America is first and foremost in the land of conspiracy theories and divisive thinking around conspiracy theories. But now it's bled into other parts of the world, like the UK. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's there's no truth anymore. It's your truth. You don't have to go to medical school for 6 to 8 years, whatever it is, and specialize in your specialist area to learn your craft. If you do a Google search, you can debunk those.
It's true.
The next episode of The Commercial Break starts now.
2:30 in the morning!
Oh, yeah, cats and kittens, welcome back to The Commercial Break. I'm Brian Green, and I'm here by myself on a Thanksgiving week. But it's a TCB Infomercial Tuesday, and the trains keep running, and they must run on time. So you're getting a fresh episode of TCB's Infomercial with Paul Chowdhury. Paul Chowdhury is here, ladies and gents. And now Chrissy wasn't here when I recorded this episode. If you remember a couple of weeks back, she took some time off. Then I fell ill. You know, it's just the round-the-clock nature of having 12 to 15 children. Someone is always experiencing some kind of sickness. And on this particular day, Chrissy had just come back from vacation, but I was not feeling well. I did not want to disappoint Paul and cancel last minute, so he and I did it together. Me in quarantine, him all the way across the pond, because Paul is an international superstar comedian sensation from the UK. He has sold out small little tiny little venues like Wembley Arena. He has headlined all over the world. He's extraordinarily popular over in the UK. He's been touring the United States for a very long time. And he's got a new tour that he'll be starting at the beginning of the year. Tickets are available at paulchowdhury.com. I, of course, will do you a favor and put links in the show notes so as to make things easy for you. You can check out his specials on Amazon Prime. There's some stuff on Comedy Central. You can find lots of content on YouTube. As most comedians have now, you know, disseminated a lot of their shit onto YouTube, because guess what? It's 2025, and that is what you do. And speaking of YouTube, you can go and check this episode out, youtube.com/thecommercialbreak. And if you want to catch us recording live streaming, then you can do that next week, Tuesday through Thursday, right around noonish. Follow us at The Commercial Break on Instagram, and then you get notified when we decide to go live. Get involved in the action. Please. We've been doing that for the last couple of weeks. We've been kind of keeping it hush-hush, but now we're letting everybody know. All three of you. We're letting all three of you know that you can stream us recording our podcast live and chat it up with us. So there you go. But that's not why we're here today. Paul Chowdhury, again, very popular comic all throughout the world. And he's coming to the U.S. to do another stint, another round of shows. So if he comes anywhere close to you, and it looks like he might be, you, whoever's listening, it looks like he might be close to you, go get tickets. PaulChowdhury.com. Links in the show notes. Let's do this. Let's take a short break. And when we get back through the magic of telepodcasting, I will have Paul right here in studio with me. We'll be back.
Hey, it's Rachel, your new voice of God here on TCB. And just like you, I'm wondering just how much longer this podcast can continue. Let's all rejoice that another episode has made it to your ears, and I'll rejoice that my check is in the mail. Speaking of mail, get your free TCB sticker in the mail by going to tcbpodcast.com and visiting the Contact Us page. You can also find the entire Commercial Break library, audio and video, just in case you want to look at Chrissy, at tcbpodcast.com. Want your voice to be on an episode of the show? Leave us a message at 212-433-3TCB. That's 212-433-3822. Tell us how much you love us, and we'll be sure to let the world know on a future episode. Or you could make fun of us. That'd be fine, too. We might not air that, but maybe. Oh, and if you're shy, that's okay. Just send a text. We'll respond. Now I'm going to go check the mailbox for payment while you check out our sponsors, and then we'll return to this episode of The Commercial Break.
And Paul is here with me now. Paul, thank you very much. Grateful for your time today. I read in my show prep and getting ready for the show, did you sell out Wembley, or you played Wembley?
I sold out Wembley a couple of tours ago, actually.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
In my old mind, the Wembley is like the Mount Everest of crowds, because I was watching, you remember the old Paradise City video from Guns N' Roses when they were playing Wembley? And I always thought that was like the Mount Everest of crowds. Like, holy shit, you play Wembley, it's like, you know, you're out there. But then I watched the video on Bonnie Blue fucking 157 men, and I thought that might be
1,057.
1,057. That might be the Mount Everest of crowd work right there.
Well, in all fairness to Guns N' Roses, they played Wembley Stadium, which is 80,000. I played the arena.
Oh.
So there's two different, so the arena or the stadium. So if, I wish I could say I was a stadium comic, but more of an arena comic. And I don't know if comedy works to 80,000.
I don't know if it does either. That's a great question. So there's comics here. Nate Bargatze and some other, you know, Tom Segura and others who go and they sell out place. I'm in Atlanta. They'll go and sell out 27,000, 30,000 seat rooms. And there's, when I've talked to other comics, they say, who have played bigger places, they say it's different. It doesn't work the same when you have, you know, 15,000-20,000 people in front of you than it does when you have 200 people in front of you. And a couple of them have admitted, I kind of like the room where there's 200 because I'm able to push the energy one way or the other with emotion or a look or a stare.
Well, this tour I did the O2 Arena.
Holy
right?
Shit.
So, and a couple of months before that, Paul McCartney was doing a show.
Unbelievable.
So I was in the same room as McCartney, and then I did Birmingham Arena. So on this tour, I did some different arena dates to Wembley, just because I'd done Wembley, so I wanted to see if I could do the O2. So just for context, that's where Madonna did her shows recently, and I saw Madonna there. And then I had the week I was doing it, it was Usher was there. So
sure.
we had the same dressing room. He wasn't there. He was there the night before and the night after me, so I shared. So actually, Usher had to take down his set so I could do my show and then put his set back up. So he probably wasn't too happy with me.
I'm doing what? For who? But in the UK, you're huge. I mean, but for you, is which experience is better, or is it just different? You just have to work the crowds differently.
Well, you know, with the arena comedy, you have screens.
Yeah.
So, So if you do talk to the front row, then you have a cameraman that pans to them, and the audience can see it, and they erupt into laughter. But it's a different type of performance because you have to wait a couple of seconds for your voice to reach the back of the stadium.
Yeah.
Or the arena. So it takes a couple of seconds. So the timing is slightly different as it would be so immediate with, you know, 200 people.
Very interesting. You have to think about the minutia of that as you're walking into the room. They're like, hey, Paul, remind yourself to give a beat. Like, give a beat so the laughter can reach the back of the room, and then I can move on to the next beat, right?
Well, going back to Wembley, that's because when I was a student, I used to help de-rig the stages. So after the show, you have a team of people that would take down all the scaffolding and the stage. And so you start after the concert finishes at around 11 o'clock and you finish at about 7 o'clock in the morning. And when I was about 20 or 21, I was working at Wembley, taking down the stage for Mariah Carey.
Whoa.
So, and then I had to carry her bags to the car. And I kind of said, just kind of glimpsed at Mariah Carey. She was like, who's this guy? He's de-rigging the stage. And I thought, one day, you know, I went from, I'll sell this room out. And then I went from de-rigging Mariah Carey's stage to then performing on the same stage as Mariah Carey.
That's insane. I have to imagine that for all the different reasons, when you're a kid, essentially, and you're de-rigging these. By the way, some of my favorite Instagram accounts, this might just be an indication of how old I am, are the guys who do the rigging and the de-rigging of these big stadiums, watching them as they shift around these huge stages and go up into the rafters. And I've always been interested by that kind of backstage life. And it's dangerous. It's hard work, but it looks like, you know, a bit of fun too. But do you still to this day, do you still get that feeling when you go into one of these rooms and you've sold it out and just 20, 25 years ago, you were the person taking down this lighting or whatever it was. Do you still get that? Holy shit, Paul, you did it.
Well, when you see the guys doing it, you realize the cost involved. So when you arena comedy has high expense. So you could do like, say, a 2,000 seat venue in Apollo or something, for example, 3,000. You could do three nights there as opposed to doing one night at a stadium or an arena. But generally, comics do it as a statement.
Yeah.
It's like an industry statement that you can do it. So, but you pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, you are paying for the privilege of playing that. And it's not an easy gig. So with the first, at the O2, it was an arena, and I did the second, I had some acts that go in on the first half and they warm up the crowd as comics do. But generally, when I do a tour show in the UK, I do the whole show. So I do around half an hour in the first section, and then we have an intermission, which you don't generally have in America. Mm-hmm. And then in the second half, I do over an hour. But at the Birmingham Arena, I thought, can I do the whole show on my own to over 10,000 people? So I did the first section and the second section, and I couldn't really speak much the next day because the projection in an arena.
That's an interesting statement that you just made, and one that I don't think I've heard before, but makes a lot of sense if you follow the industry and you understand, especially what a lot of musicians have been talking about for years. Mm-hmm. And that is that these big stadiums, even the medium-sized rooms, the expense involved in putting on a show and getting there and getting the riggers and all the stuff, right? Everything from, you know, craft services to, you know, making sure there's some food in the dressing room to all this other stuff. And the immense amount of money that the ticketing agencies and the arenas themselves and the production companies take away from every single seat sold in the building makes it almost, if you break even, you've won the day. Like, you've won. If you, you know, almost if you break even, you think that, oh, he's selling out the O2 Arena. He just made $6 million. That's likely not true, right? It's likely that you broke even, but you did it because you could do it. It's almost like it's a flex, it's a statement, and hopefully an attention grabber for the next big thing that you're going to do.
Yeah, I wish I could make $6 million a show.
That would be awesome.
You know, that's Beyonce kind of level. I think she charges $1 million a corporate.
She charges $1 million a corporate gig.
I think it's $1 million a corporate, if not more.
Do you do corporate gigs? Are you open to the idea?
I've done a lot. Yeah, I do. I do corporate shows. I do birthdays. I do anything. I'm available for
quinceañeras, you
know, wedding. I've done weddings. I've done bar mitzvahs. I almost got attacked a few of them. I remember I did one just after Will Smith slapped Chris Rock at the Oscars, and I did some routines in a wedding kind of function tent in somebody's house, and one of the guests almost attacked me just after. Yeah, so I've had these types of events. Corporate's quite dangerous shows to do.
You know, I understand it, though, because when someone's waggling a check in front of you and all you have to do is just go up there, knock out 30, 40 an hour, whatever you're contracted to do. And, you know, you're not taking, I mean, you would like to think you're not, it's not like you're doing something outside of the norm of what you would do. You're just doing your act in front of a smaller crowd that's paid you to do it. It's almost in some sense, you know, that's like just icing on the cake. You're walking well, and you're knocking it out. But why did you get attacked?
I remember I did a show for a family, and then I got flown out to Dubai, and I did a wedding, and it was only to these Muslim men on a rooftop in this multi-million pound property in the Beverly Hills part of Dubai. So I go out and I did the Dubai Opera House on my last tour, but I go out to these weird and wacky kind of like, you know, weddings or wherever. And they went down, you know, it went down all right. They seemed to enjoy it. Yeah. And then I got called to do another wedding in the UK for somebody that was related to that family. And that, so whenever I do a corporate show or if I did your birthday, I'd ask you for some information about your friends or your family. And then I'd do some jokes about them, right? So you don't do your conventional set because it never works. So it's got to be about them.
Yeah.
And then one guy, so the guy getting married said, call my cousin gay, which obviously I've got not an issue with, but sure. I called the guy gay and the whole audience erupted into laughter. Everyone was laughing except the guy called gay. And he wasn't laughing, and neither were his wife and kids.
I may
have taken it a bit too far with that. And then he rushed the stage and grabs the mic off me and said, "If you can you swear on this podcast?"
Of course, I'm not sure. Yeah, no, go for it. Yeah,
He used a few expletives at me and said, if you continue to say this, I'm going to punch you in the fucking head.
No.
And push the mic down. And at that point, he had to be kind of pulled off me. And and then his dad got involved and said, you know, this isn't appropriate material for a family, Muslim family audience. So it goes completely. And I said, well, it was good enough for Wembley Arena.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you've got to get yourself out of this position now and make them laugh again. So then I had to then dig my way back out of that hole.
And then, wow. Wow.
So, yeah. So you think Chris Rock had a hard time?
Yeah. Listen, I saw Chris a couple weeks, month, whatever. It was his first gig after he went, after the big slap. Mm. Right. And, you know, he was obviously shaken by the whole thing. That was a very, very public disturbance in the force. Let's put it that way. I still don't know what that shit was about, but it feels like to me that in comedy, small stages, big stages all around the world and any live performance, it is getting more dangerous in a sense. I think people have, they're quicker to snap. They're quicker to get aggressive. They don't respect the boundaries. They don't understand, you know, comedy is not every, you can't please everybody all the time. And every line isn't going to hit with everybody the same way. But it feels to me, and I just think this is anecdotal, but probably is true. People are quick to get crazy. They're quick to snap. And, you know, we've seen it. People bum rush the stage. They throw shit at musicians. They attack comics on stage. You know, have you experienced any of this outside this one instance? Have you ever?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing comedy for 26 years now.
Yeah.
Right. So I've been attacked. I've been people waiting for me outside. I've had death threats. I've had the police come to my house three times to take statements because I've had online threats. I've, you know, are you guys experience out there? The difference in the UK is they don't carry guns, right?
So right.
So the threat is slightly less in the UK than it is in America. I know it's slightly more dangerous. But the comedy has changed because 26, 25 years ago, when I broke into the club, say 24 years ago, people understood that jokes on stage were jokes. And now people are taking this very seriously. So when I say, if I was set to say this at Parliament or at the White House, they're not, it doesn't, it's not a joke. But when I'm saying on a comedy stage, at a show that's been billed as a comedy show and you're buying tickets for a comedy show, they should be taken as a joke, no matter what the subject. But we don't live in that time anymore.
No, people are so entrenched in their own divisive thought. And I can't exclude myself sometimes from that too. I don't think I would bum rush a stage, but it's like everything is so damn personal, you know, and it's really not. I always thought of comedy as a little bit of a noble profession in the sense that it allows people to open up, right? When you're laughing, you're opening up even to ideas that otherwise you wouldn't, you know, if you're talking to your friend or watching a news story, whatever, you wouldn't think. And then it's like a Trojan horse. It allows for additional perspectives to come in your brain or for you to laugh at something that otherwise you don't find funny on a normal day. And then you go, yeah, maybe that's not so serious. Or maybe I could think about things this different way. But not everybody is there. You know, there's people out there that are not well. They're just not well. And they, you know,
I think the internet has created this kind of discourse where people take you very seriously. Like when I put a clip, I'm very careful now as to what clips to upload on the internet because people are scrolling. And as soon as they see something that they, people are only offended by material when it affects them. So yeah. I could do 10 jokes about something which is so offensive, but I do one joke about say a sweatshirt that you're wearing with letters on it, for example, like, and that could affect you. What, or you wear glasses and I do a joke about glasses. You're offended by that because you wear glasses. You can, people are only affected by jokes when it's about them, really. Yeah. Or it affects them in some way. But yeah, I think as long as it's funny, if I don't have to like the subject matter. You know, well, I worked with Patrice O'Neill when he was around in America and the UK. Now, I didn't agree with him on his viewpoints. Was it funny? That's the point. Was it funny?
Yeah. And it was.
Exactly.
You've been doing this for a long time, right? You said you were around with Patrice and Bill Burr. Have you worked with Bill also?
Bill Burr first came to the UK around 2007. He did the Leicester Square Theatre in London, which I performed at way back then. And a lot of Americans, Leslie Jones was just there a few months ago from Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. Oh, I saw this. So Bill wanted a, I used to do a golf club in Ruislip. This is just on the outskirts of London where, out, so in the UK clubs, you used to get to do 20 minutes, right? But this club would book me to do, say, 40 to 50 minutes.
Okay.
So I'd do about 50 minutes of stage time. And so you'd get to do an extended comedy set. And then you'd have an opener. And then Bill came to, he was in London, and the promoter reached out to him and said, do you want to warm up for your show? Do you want to, you fancy coming down to my gig? So he said, yeah, I'll come down and warm up. So he was my opening act.
That's incredible.
Bill Burr came to London and opened for me at the at this golf club.
That's crazy.
And then I met him and his wife, and he invited me to the show the next day at the Leicester Square Theatre, which he did two nights, and there was only half full on each night. And Bill wasn't really, and then he went on to do Breaking Bad and the likes of that, and his specials. And this was pre-Netflix, of
wow.
course, right?
Yeah.
So, and then Bill went on to be you know, I'm not sure what he went on to become, but I haven't heard of him since.
Yeah, he's a very famous podcaster and political commentary. He's done.
If you're listening, Bill, I gave you your first break in the UK. Yeah, it would help.
Yeah, what's up? Can you come and open for Paul when he's in America in the next couple of weeks? He would appreciate it.
He won't even open the door for me.
Yeah, well, you know, Bill seems like one of those accessible guys, but you know. You never know someone until you meet. Actually, yeah. I had a chance to interview Bill Burr. One of our first interviews was on this thing called Clubhouse. Did you do Clubhouse during the pandemic? Like the audio app where people would go in and start rooms? And
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I heard about this. Like, everybody, all the comics were on that.
Yeah, Twitter Spaces. So when this podcast was early, we had a friend who the two of us interviewed Bill Burr. Could not have been nicer, spent an hour and a half with us. And so I don't have anything but nice things to say about Bill because all I know about him is being nice. But when you come to the United States and obviously you can't use some of the same material around the world. You've got to tailor it. And you're an international comic. You're doing this all over the world, right? Does it take you a couple of shows when you get to the United States to kind of warm up into the material, see where the crowd is going, understand? I would imagine when you move a location like that, you know, what do they say? All real estate is local. All comedy might be local too.
I did last year, I did the City Winery in New York and Boston, Chicago, and I did Canada as well.
Yeah.
And it's just the reference points really. So when I do this tour, I've got to then, so this is a different tour. Last year, the show was called Family Friendly. This one in America is called AI, Artificial Indian. So, you know, because people don't, sometimes they can't put the English, because I got a London accent.
Yeah.
But I'm an Indian guy. So my family immigrated. My dad came to England in 1964 and I was born in the 70s, of course. But they don't normally see, they don't put the two and two together. But as you know, Indians were everywhere now. But I'm British, basically. I'm a British act. So it's really the Americanisms which you change, you know, a supermarket, I might change whatever, like in the UK, say Sainsbury's to Walmart. So these right. little things. So I was just in America. I was doing the Comedy Cellar for a couple of weeks. So, you know, I just thought I'd dip my toe in and I always wanted to try to play the Cellar for years. And I just thought, you know what, I haven't done the clubs in years. And I just reached out to them and they gave me a couple of weeks of shows out there. So I just kind of warmed up a bit.
Yeah, of course they did. I mean, you know, you're a huge touring act. The Comedy Cellar, by the way, for those of you that don't know, is a storied comedy club, not one that might get as much attention as, you know, the Comedy Store or Caroline's or whatever, but the Comedy Cellar is extraordinarily well known as a place to go and cut your teeth, right? Go out there and cut your teeth and work on your act and put a few jokes together. Paul and I were talking right before we came on, and Paul kindly said that he had listened to the latest episode of the show, which as he was listening to it is actually me rebroadcast or republishing the psychic after the break, the new show that I am doing. Thank you very much for the kind words. You come from a family that believes in this kind of mystic magic?
No, I mean, weirdly you say that because there's a woman that's gone viral on Instagram.
Okay.
Sylvia
Brown.
Brown.
Yes.
Because she was on the Montel Williams show in the 1990s.
In the
you spoke about it. You said the worst one.
The worst of the worst. Yes.
And it was great. If I urge everyone to listen to this episode.
Thank you.
It's a great, great episode. And you really do a deep dive into these psychics, and people want to believe there's something out there. But they, and I didn't know that, because there was a fact you told me that you tried to speak to Montel about the show, but he wouldn't give any interviews on it. But
no.
The fact that he gave her a platform, and Honey the Land is what now people are quoting on Instagram.
They call it, they're calling what? They're calling her
Honey,
what?
Honey the Land.
Honey the Land. Yeah.
So there was an episode where some woman says, you know, I lost my husband. Do you know where he is now? And Sylvia says, I'm sensing water. Water, he's deep in water. And then the woman says, he died in 9/11.
Yes.
No, but I'm getting water.
She's sprayed with water. I remember this. Yes.
He drowned.
He drowned in the water. Yeah.
But he drowned in 9/11.
Yeah. She was most definitely. And listen, you know, I'm not here to make a judgment call on whether or not any of this is true or not. Obviously, there's no, I don't see any scientific proof out there, but people can believe what they want to believe. But this woman was so terrible in the sense that Montel would bring on these grieving parents or grieving wife or husband or whatever it was, gone missing, not found, years gone, or even it might even be fresh a couple of months, and investigators had run up against, you know, nothing. They couldn't find anything, a cold case essentially. And she would start just telling people falsehoods, bullshitting them. And then after the show, which you don't know what I don't get to there, but after the show, and this has now been found out through many conversations and interviews with people who had interactions with Sylvia on the Montel show, is that Sylvia would approach them afterwards and ask them to pay her to give them additional money, thousands and thousands of dollars. If you give me $20,000, I can spend some time on this and get further. And some people did, and most people did not. But she was, you remember the Natalie Holloway case, the girl who went missing in Aruba? Yaron Vandersloot ended up that fucking douchebag from wherever he was from, the Dutch colonies or whatever. She actually claimed that Natalie was alive and that she was being held by whatever, you know, sex kidnapping ring. The girl was dead, but she strung that mother along just like she strung many mothers along. And that's where I take issue with psychics. If you're calling a psychic hotline because you're having trouble with your love life and you want to see, you know, if somebody has any indication if you're going to fall in love, cool. If you're out there prognosticating about whether or not an investigation is going in a certain direction is correct, or someone's dead or alive or kidnapped, that's where I just go, I get nuts in my own head. I'm like, how could these people do this to these grieving folks? Luckily, I don't come from a family that believes any of this stuff. Like, my parents were pretty pragmatic, but I know there's a lot of families that are like really into this kind of shit.
So you've heard of James Randi, who's no longer with us, right?
Yes, I have. Yes.
So James Randi exposed these people. There's a great documentary on Prime, which is called An Honest Liar. So he exposes Uri Geller, a lot of these psychics, he went down, you know, quite badly for exposing them. So because people want to believe,
they do.
Kind of people want to believe a lie, because it's something they get from believing there's something after this existence that we're in now, and we have some connection to people aren't here anymore.
You know what I think it is, Paul? I think it's the mind abhors a vacuum, right? The mind abhors a vacuum. And when we don't have information, and when we can't get that information, it's just why I think conspiracy theories run wild on the internet these days. It's because in the absence of information, in a world that's flooding you with information, we get crazed when there's not an answer to something that makes sense or it's not immediate. And just like that, the psychics offer something to people who are obviously having mental trauma, emotional trauma. And that is, they've just lost someone, or they've lost someone at some point.
conspiracy theory was an experiment, wasn't it? In the 60s or 70s, they tried to see if they could make people believe things that didn't exist and how far it traveled. So it was an experiment. And now it's the norm.
It was like a game of telephone at first, wasn't it? Like the CIA would... And didn't the CIA put out UFO, like certain kind of UFO conspiracies that then were like driven by other conspiracy? Like the CIA did some damage by playing these games, and now people have gone crazy. Does this affect the... I'm getting the sense that it's that America is first and foremost in the land of conspiracy theories and divisive thinking around conspiracy theories. But now it's bled into other parts of the world, like the UK. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no truth anymore. It's your truth. You don't have to go to medical school for 6 to 8 years, whatever it is, and specialize in your specialist area to learn your craft. If you do a Google search, you can debunk those.
It's true.
Whatever they've, you know, because we're all being lied to, and we live in an age where everyone's lying to us. And also conspiracy theories makes, it's almost like believing a skeptic, isn't it? You want to believe things that make you feel better about yourself.
It's true. And I think there's some part deep down also is that people want to believe they have some inside track, some inside knowledge. Mm. Like it makes them feel like they have some control over situations that may not be in their own control. Like I really know what's going on. I really understand what's going on. All right, back to comedy. Tell me. All right, back to comedy before we make this whole episode about conspiracy theories, which I could talk about all day long, by the way. Tell me, what did you find funny as a kid? Like what were some of the first things? Did you always want to be a comic? Is this a play? Like were you the funny guy in the family? Were you the funny guy at school?
I was a serious guy. I think people would say I was more of the serious guy, you know. But then I would say things that people would find funny in a serious manner. And that's where I thought, I grew up to a lot of horror films I'd watch as a kid.
Oh, really?
And also comedy was, I'd say in the 1970s or 80s, quite primitive in the UK in comparison to America. So you had the alternative comedians, but we had mainstream comics in the UK who would do I don't know if you know about British comedy. It was very different to the Americans. And then
I am very up to speed on British comedy, by the way. It's my favorite kind of comedy.
So, oh, really?
Yes. I love the shows. I love all of it. I'm a big fan. So
back then, you know, I grew up, you know, I'd say the biggest export we had at that time was Benny Hill,
Benny Hill
in America.
Yep.
Now, looking back on Benny Hill, it's actually quite, it wasn't really a respected form of comedy. It was quite sexist and misogynistic. You know, you couldn't get away with that kind of stuff anymore. No. Michael Jackson's favorite comedian, apparently, right? He went to see him on his deathbed.
It's insane. Yeah.
So I grew up to, you know, Morecambe and Wise, like all these guys. And then I dove into Pryor when I was, I'd say in the 80s, I was listening to Pryor, Kinison, obviously Eddie Murphy back then in the Delirious era.
Yeah.
But we'd get cassettes back then. So I'd listen to it on my Walkman. Carlin. So I was introduced to, well, like you kind of discovered them. Because in those days, you'd have to go and buy a cassette tape, which is people don't even have the players anymore. No. And then it moved on to CD. And now, obviously, you know, things are going to just disappear now. But back then, comedy was very different. So I had to go to Tower Records and buy these things. Into central London. You wouldn't even get it in your local area.
You had to go downtown.
Yeah, you had to go downtown. Yeah. It would take you 1 hour to get there to go and buy a tape to listen to it.
Wow. Yeah, this is our adventure. Yeah.
You know, so I grew up who was say the biggest comic in the 80s in America? We didn't really get an SNL. Was never broadcast in the UK. I think they tried it once or twice. They did a few. It's actually coming to the UK now.
Okay.
But they're doing a UK version of it. So American comedy and British comedy is quite different. That's why you don't get many British stand-ups doing the American scene as much.
It's
but now it's changing.
It's different. And in the 80s, you know, that you're right. You just named all the heavy hitters. And, you know, Andrew Dice Clay and Sam Kennison and Carlin, of course, was he's just a different kind of comic, right? He's almost a poet, a commentarian.
Hicks was huge here. Hicks was really big. So when Bill Hicks, because he did the Edinburgh Festival, which made him big in the UK.
Yeah.
Carlin was more of an observational comic at first, and then when he became political, that's when he kind of blew up. But still, he wouldn't be known to the everyman in England.
Right. No, Hicks was huge here, but not as big as I think he rightfully deserved, right? I don't think he would be named with, I think some people would, but I don't think he would be named with Carlin and Murphy and Kennison, because those guys, they were just putting out these incredible hour and a half.
Yeah.
So did this connect with you when you were listening to these tapes over, I'm sure, well, like on repeat, like I was, is it connecting with you?
Yeah, it was Seinfeld was playing. So I grew up, so to say, the Larry Sanders Show, right?
Okay.
So,
yep. Great show.
And it was one of the best.
Of course.
And then Seinfeld, I first discovered on Rodney Dangerfield's, he did a compilation show where Kinison was headlining. And I don't know if Dice on that? I don't think Dice was on that.
I don't think Dice and Dangerfield crossed paths on it. I think you're talking about an HBO special or a Showtime special that Dangerfield did. Yeah.
It was Phil. So he had the Dangerfield's Club. Yeah, that was when. But Kinison wasn't really known in the UK either. Sam Kinison wasn't known here.
Wow.
And it was a very American style of comedy. So over here, it was more set up punchline, whereas he was like rants and screaming. And he went on to become a stadium comic, right? So one of the first after someone like Dice.
Yeah.
So Dice. But then if you look back at Dice, you know, Dice has now made a comeback. He's done a movie with Eddie Murphy, but. Back then, you know, I remember the days when he got cancelled from MTV. So that was the first incarnation. But now you look back on that kind of comedy, stuff like the Pryor stuff hasn't dated too badly. But I don't know if the Dice stuff has aged that well.
No. I agree with you. I don't think a Hickory Dickory Dock is is on the top of anybody's list. You know, it's like, I agree. Dice was one of the first stadium comics, Murphy and Dice, right? They and Carlin would do big rooms. I don't know if he did stadiums, but he would do big rooms for sure. But
Dice opened for Guns N' Roses, and I actually saw Axl Rose this close to me because he did a Q&A in Soho with Jimmy Chang, who owns a restaurant called China Tang.
Okay.
At the Dorchester in Park Lane in London, and he used to have like a video podcast, and I was front row, and Axl Rose came in a walking stick, and there was only like 50 people there with me, and he came in really late, and he just did a Q&A with, he'd since died actually, Jimmy Chang, but Axl Rose was literally, I said hello to Axl Rose there, and I was thinking, you know, this is literally, why has he come to do this? But he just used to come and then I saw Slash, because he was here recently, because I went to a party and the lead singer of AC/DC did a thing with Slash on stage for an industry party on TV.
Holy shit. You know, Jimmy Chang's had a restaurant chain called Tang's, right? So it's called Tang's. So we did a whole episode about this because apparently back in the 80s and early 90s, meet me at Tang's was a thing that people would do. They had like a location out in LA, a couple locations out in California, and people went crazy for Tang's. We actually got some merch made and it said, meet me at Tang's.
Yeah. So I used to do it in the afternoon in Chinatown in London.
Okay.
And that's where so he'd get the biggest A-listers at this. So he had some connections for some reason. And then he just used to release them online on a video. I think it's probably still available on YouTube.
Wow.
He's no longer with us. He since had a heart attack, didn't he?
Yeah, he passed away. Yeah, we read that also.
Very young guy he was. Must have been late 50s.
That's, you know, when you get to a certain age, are you feeling the way that I'm feeling when you get to a certain age and then you like read in the obituaries, like guys like Tang's, you know, they die at 55, 57 years old, you know, died in his sleep or died of a massive heart attack. And you go, holy shit, that's not like old guys dying. That's like I could be that guy in a couple of years. It makes me,
you know,
it upsets
when
me.
You get, yeah, when you get to this age, I think you're probably a bit younger than me.
A little bit younger than me.
So, and then you start to think, you know, when you can see your retirement age, like now, you have a pension in America?
We don't have pensions in America. I mean, there are companies, some companies that offer them, but we don't have like a governmental pension. We have Social Security, which won't be around when I retire. So, you know, we've wrecked that. We've driven that into the ground.
So, you know, like, but when do you retire is like, one of my favorite comics was Jackie Mason.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I saw his last few tours in the UK and I was at his last ever show and he was in his late 70s by that point. And as with George Carlin, right?
Yeah.
They did it until they're dead. But when do you stop doing this? Because when I do these big shows and I'm on the road for like months at a time, I'm thinking, man, this is grueling at this age now. But I couldn't feel it when I was young. I've been doing this over half my life now.
Yep.
You know, touring America is different to touring in the UK. In the UK, I could go up and down the country twice within 1 week and you won't feel it. But in America, the UK is almost the same, if not a tiny bit bigger than New York State. So we're a tiny little island in comparison to you guys.
It is crazy because of the United States. My wife is Venezuelan, right? So, when I met her, she lived in Venezuela. So, you know, she's been here for about 10 years, but she had been coming to America. She had family here for a long time, but she always says that the thing that has surprised me most about being a citizen of the United States is how incredibly large the United States is and how many different looks and feels there are in the United States. You can be in a desert and then you can fly 4 hours and you can be in subtropical weather down in Florida, you know, and you're still in the same country. And when you're touring around, I'm sure, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles kind of thing, it must be another inside of a hotel room, catching another plane, catching another train. And I can imagine that at my age, it's part of the reason why I don't tour is because I have small children. But second of all, I don't know that my body or my mind would hold up well to that kind of pressure. I think it takes a certain, you've been doing it for a long time. So, you know, this is like rinse and repeat for you, but you've built up a certain tolerance for the bullshit. I don't know that I have that tolerance for the bullshit.
Yeah, you couldn't start at this age. You got to start young. And like I was watching a documentary on one of my favorite horror films last night called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, yeah.
Which I went to revisit because it's like 50 plus years old now. Right?
Crazy, yeah.
Now, that was filmed in the depths of Texas in 1973, right? So the reason that movie existed was because people don't know how people live in the deep, deep parts of America, which you don't even see. You know, in London, in the UK, you people can't really hide away too much. But in America, you can hide into little crannies and you don't even know where they are in the woods somewhere.
No, it's so big that it's so vast that there are places, you know, there's like, I have a friend whose parents are cattle ranchers and they own like 120,000 acres of land in the west part of the United States, 120,000 acres. I own less than half an acre where I live, and I complain about doing the lawn, right? But you imagine how lost you could get on just that one family's property. And there are hundreds, if not thousands of people that own that kind of property here in the United States. And it really is a vast country. Do you enjoy any parts of the, like, are there any crowds specific to the regions in the United States that feel more comfortable for you? Like some people say the South is more friendly, right? Some people say that New York and Chicago are my kind of places. Some people love LA.
Well, you know, doing London, New York, LA, Chicago, that's kind of doing a city, right?
Yeah. So,
but when you go into other areas, that's when you're going to discover yourself.
Yeah,
when you go into, when you go to some township in South Africa, when you go to some small town in New Zealand or Australia, and that's when you think, am I really funny? Or is it just the cosmopolitan cities, which get to see everything anyway?
Yeah.
I want to perform to the family in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That's when you realize, you know.
Did you know that story is, do you know the Ed Gein story? Have you watched that on Netflix yet?
Yeah, so the Ed Gein story. Well, interesting that whole thing was, the actor put on that weird voice for Ed Gein.
Yes.
Which if you listen to the tapes, there's some tapes available of Ed Gein's actual voice. I think it would have been scarier if he played it as Ed Gein's normal voice, because he had a normal, deep kind of voice. It just sounded like a normal dude. He didn't go, "Hey, I'm Ed Gein. I want to take you out."
He sounded like Michael Jackson. "I didn't do it. I didn't touch those boys."
He was a Kermit the Frog Michael Jackson voice. He kind of, you made you almost feel sorry for the guy, but you know, that voice, I'm not sure why the actor put that voice on. He said it would make him look more sinister, but it made you feel as if the guy had special needs.
I agree.
Which he obviously did.
But. Obviously he did. He had a problem. But I agree with you. I think he was trying to play it so that the audience, my opinion, he made a choice, a conscious decision, the director probably with him, to give some empathy toward this character that we were going to see through these entire 7 episodes. But, you know, when the first time that I heard his voice too, I go, did Ed Gein really talk like that? I also did the research and then also figured out doesn't sound at all like Ed Gein. It sounds like he's making some weird voice for affectation purposes.
Most of the show was made up.
Yeah, wasn't involved.
Most of it was made up. I'm big into the. And you guys do make the best serial killers. I have to give you that, America.
Thank you.
When it comes to serial killers, you're the best. We can't. Although we did have Dr. Harold Shipman. I'm not sure if you knew about him.
No.
He was a doctor in the UK who would just kill old patients by giving them lethal injections. So we don't know how many he killed. He could be the biggest serial killer of all time. He was based in the north of England.
No shit.
So his name was Dr. Harold Shipman. So hopefully they'll make a Netflix. He might get his own Netflix series. This is the thing. The more people you kill, the more chance you have of a Netflix series.
Well, Ed only confirmedly killed 2 people. So, you know, and he got his whole thing. But he did dig up a bunch of people. But, I mean, he's like kind of the beginning of this whole, you know. Listen, we do make serial killers. It's a very uniquely American thing that people go out and murder en masse, right?
But you know what kills serial killers, right?
What's that?
What killed them off? Well, you don't get as many anymore.
Tell me.
CCTV.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, that when you think about it, that's a good point.
It's CCTV and camera phones.
Yeah, because everyone's recording everything 24 hours a day.
Yeah, you can't. He would never have got away with most. You didn't even know if he killed his own brother. Most of the thing isn't fact checked. So, are there any survivors from that time? It was 19. You know, it was in the Second World War. So there's no way of fact checking any of this stuff.
No.
But say I actually went back and watched the Menendez brothers one, where now people want them out of prison, right?
Yeah. It's a fantastic show, by the way. That was really well done, the Menendez brothers.
Was that your favorite of the monsters?
I think the Menendez brothers was probably my favorite. I did like the one also about the guy who killed Versace. Was it Versace? Yeah.
Gianni Versace.
I did like that one too.
Well, I don't think that was a monster season, but it was a great show.
Yeah.
It was a great show.
What was your favorite one?
And then there was the first season was, what was his name? The gay serial killer.
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, that was really good too. Oh, that was super fantastic also. And a lot of the facts, I went back and watched that and married it up to some facts. Not everything's true because it's all serialized, right? They take a lot of artistic liberty in all of these series. But I think Jeffrey Dahmer it's pretty aligned with the story. And I was alive during that Jeffrey Dahmer time. And
me too.
Yeah. Dahmer was one twisted motherfucker. I mean,
I did some jokes about that in the last special. I did some jokes about Jeffrey Dahmer because his first victim was a white guy.
Yeah.
And then there's the rest of his, because he lived in a black neighborhood. Yep. So the rest of his victims were all from ethnic minority groups, which goes to prove that white people are very bland. You know, if you want flavor, you go ethnic. So that almost got to be canceled here.
Yeah, people want the Menendez brothers out of jail because they think that, you know, that they essentially their parents were paying the penance for these bad deeds. But,
well, arguably, I think they were molested.
I do too.
I believe that side of it. Now, what I couldn't understand was going, and they didn't just kill their parents. They blew them into, literally, they were in there like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Predator.
Yeah.
You know, they went off with sawn off shotguns and blew them to smithereens.
Yes.
You know, that was, you know, that takes something. Have you ever done that before?
Not recently. It's been 6-7 years since I've taken a sawed off shotgun to anybody. And, you know,
it'll take another 6-7 years to get the courage to do that.
Yeah. Listen, these guys had some super anger in them and they were ready to go. I mean, they were ready to go. But I think also they were driven by the fact that not only were they molested, and that probably had, you know, your psyche is fucked. If you're getting molested at that age by your parents, your psyche is fucked. Then the fact that the father was such a weird, strict bastard, right? And the mother was kind of out of it and pilled up and all this other stuff. But then there's a lot to gain from those two being murdered, right? There's a lot to gain financially. It means freedom from the tyranny, freedom from the abuse, but it also means financial freedom for the rest of their lives.
Well, the therapist told, you know, it was because the therapist that got caught. Yeah. And people say therapy is good for you.
Yeah.
But it didn't help them.
Didn't help them one bit. They did not. They got a raw deal on that therapist. And it turns out, yeah, he wasn't even like a therapist. He had gotten like a weekend.
It was the therapist's girlfriend, though, wasn't it? Because he told the girlfriend who was having an affair.
Yeah.
So he was a shit therapist. And then the therapist screwed him over.
It was such a twisted series of events. I mean, honestly.
Why is the therapist not in prison?
Yeah, you know, he wasn't a therapist. That's why he's not in prison. He was like, seriously, he got like a weekend degree from DeVry. And he was just helping people out on the side. He was,
you know, if Ed Gein got therapy, he would have gone to court years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Ed Gein needs the therapy. But, you know, he lived so far away from a therapist, he couldn't go to a therapist. So tell me, when does the tour start here in the United States?
So, good question. That's a great question.
By the way, all the links are in the show notes, as they always are, listener. So, you know, Paul's got a lot of stuff on his mind. He's got a pack.
I start in on the 6th of January in LA, and then I'm in Seattle, Denver, San Fran, Chicago, Washington, New York, Toronto, Philly, Dallas, Atlanta. It goes on.
Oh, great. You're coming to Atlanta. Where are you in Atlanta? Are you playing like a club or a bigger hall?
Georgia. GA.
In Georgia?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Atlanta, Georgia. I'm not saying, do you know which club you're playing or which
you're playing? It's one of the theaters there.
Oh, I'm so excited. I will come see you. Atlanta, Paul, I'm going to come see you. I would like to see you. I've really enjoyed this conversation. We can shoot the shit about, you're playing the Buckhead Theater, buddy. Look at you.
Buckhead, that's it, the Buckhead,
Look at you.
Is named after a very famous double act you had called Beavis and Buckhead back in the MTV days.
Good old Buckhead, Georgia. That is the Buckhead is the Dubai of Atlanta, just to let you know. That is where all the rich people are. And so that's a good place.
It's the Dubai of Georgia.
Atlanta. It's the Dubai of Atlanta.
Really?
It's our little...
Well, I'm not Muslim, but I'll try.
Have you played? You did play Dubai, right? You went and played there?
I did the Dubai Opera House. That's the last date I did in Dubai. I actually did an arena in Dubai just after lockdown. So,
no shit.
I socially did. It was only a couple of thousand people because it was like a 15,000 seat room, but they had to socially distance people. So it was sold out at 2,500.
Wow.
So.
I've always wanted to visit Dubai. That's like one of those places that's kind of on the list because it seems like a Disney World for money and adult. You know what I'm saying? Like it seems like it just born out of nothing and they just made this amazingly shiny pretty thing. And I'm a fan of big projects and engineering and all that. And I feel like Dubai is one of those places.
Well, the country's about my age, but most of it's sinking because it's just a man-made, you know,
sand.
You're not supposed to be living there really, are you?
No.
It's inhabitable.
Yeah. It turns out that just dumping a bunch of sand in the middle of the ocean and making islands with big buildings on them wasn't all that well thought out.
Well, then they do the they make the clouds as well. They can make it rain out there now.
Yeah, that's what I heard, that they're seeding the clouds and they make it rain. That's insane.
Cloud seeding.
Yeah. There's got to be some repercussion to that at some point. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, they had the floods, didn't they?
Yeah, oh, yeah, so, that's right. Oh.
So they couldn't then control the floods, and then it went out of control.
Whoops. Well, they have enough money, they'll figure it out. Paul is on tour. Paul, where can we see your most recent special also?
So my most recent special, I think I'm not allowed to say this, but I think somebody illegally uploaded it onto YouTube.
Oh, okay. So you can illegally not give Paul money by watching it on YouTube.
So before I get it taken down because it was illegally uploaded, you know, I hope you don't see it.
Yeah. Okay. So listeners, don't go watch Paul's latest special on YouTube, illegally uploaded by someone not yet named.
Otherwise in the UK, it's on Sky TV or Now TV, which doesn't work in America.
I tried.
So I'm going to find the bastard who illegally uploaded it on YouTube before you guys watch it.
Well, you look straight in the mirror and you go find that guy. All right. Also, additionally, he's on tour here starting in January. Paul, you are welcome back anytime, my friend. We would love to have you. And I will try and get to the Buckhead Theater because it's right down the street. I would like to come watch you do some jokes.
An honor and a privilege. And, you know, I've been doing this all my life, which has led up to the biggest. I've gone from playing. I thought I don't need arenas anymore. I don't need to be playing the same rooms as Beyonce Knowles, Taylor Swift, and the likes. I need to go into the Buckhead.
Buckhead Theater in Atlanta, Georgia. Be there or be square. He's now made it on the biggest comedy podcast in all of North Atlanta. And so he's on his way up. We can talk.
Oh, an honor and a privilege.
Thanks, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Rachel here. While Brian takes his old man bladder to the little boys' room, let's talk turkey. TCB needs your help. If you love the show, do us all a favor and share. Sharing is caring, and we know you care, don't you? Well, don't you? Ooh, that was some childhood trauma. Rearing its ugly head. Do you want to be on the show? Leave us a voicemail at 212-433-3822, and you could be the next TCB disembodied voice. Ooh, what'd you do today? I was a disembodied voice. You know, that sounds more dangerous than it actually is. Find us on Insta at The Commercial Break, on the web at tcbpodcast.com, and all the episodes on video are available the same day at youtube.com/thecommercialbreak. I'm going to go help Brian get back up the stairs while you listen to the sponsors, and then we'll all meet back here and get back to this episode of The Commercial Break. I'll take a raise now, bitches. Bye.
All right, that's going to be the last interview that I do for a while without Chrissy. She's my security blanket. She's my binky. She's my baba. I love her very much, and I want her to come home. And she will, but not this week. I mean, not this episode. She'll be back next week on the next TCB infomercial. And don't you worry, throughout the holiday, we are smashing new episodes left and right. And you know where you would have heard those episodes first? On our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thecommercialbreak. Now streaming all of our episodes as we record them, except for the celebrity TCB infomercial episodes. Those you'll have to wait until Tuesday. But if you want to catch early previews of us and you want to get involved and you want to be a part of the action, then you got to follow us, youtube.com/thecommercialbreak. Hit the notifications. Make sure you get notified when we go live, or follow us on Instagram @thecommercialbreak. So many exciting things happening around here. Listen, I have been wrong. I have been wrong. Maya Copas, apologies. Coup d'etat to you. All of the people who have been texting us, I really apologize. We had a little problem with the phone, and then I got the phone fixed, and now it's the holiday, and blah, blah, blah. I'm going to respond to everybody this holiday weekend. You could hear from me on Thanksgiving. On Thanksgiving. Isn't that exactly what you want? Give thanks. for the mediocre comedy podcast that puts out way too many episodes for way too little money. Hey, that's our problem, not yours. Okay, I'll accept that on face value. All right. 212-433-3TCB, 212-433-3822. Questions, comments, concerns, content ideas. We're going to respond. We're going to get to it. You know, I'm one of those people. Everything else distracts me. I'm like a cat with a shiny toy, little squirrel with a nut. I run around the yard. I don't know which way I'm going. And then eventually I make my way up the tree with the nut. Okay, I'll get to it this weekend. Yeah, I already said YouTube.com and all that jazz. I already said at the commercial break on Instagram and all that jazz. And I'll remind you to go to the website, tcbpodcast.com. Get your free sticker, all the audio, all the video. Okay, on behalf of Chrissy and I'll tell you that I love you. Best to you. I hope you have a great holiday week. Until next time, I will say, I do say, and I must say, goodbye.